This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jesse Hagopian. He's a high school teacher in Seattle, Washington. He's an editor at Rethinking Schools magazine. His new book is More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High-Stakes Testing. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So how did you get into this whole movement? Tell us a little bit about your own background. This really goes back to your own childhood and schooling.
Well, that's for sure. These tests humiliated me, and I can remember vividly the first time I ever saw my standardized test scores in third grade. And I remember the blue line that showed the average score and the black dot all the way at the bottom representing me. And I knew from that moment until probably about halfway through college that I wasn't intelligent, and I had the test scores to prove it. And what I realized in college was that it wasn't that I was below average or underachieving. It's that I just had skills that didn't easily register on standardized tests. So I could communicate my ideas out loud, but that doesn't register on a standardized test, right? I was a musician and had musical capabilities and talents, but that didn't register either. And you know, in college, those things were encouraged and promoted, and it no longer became about eliminating wrong answer choices and filling in A, B, C, D bubbles. At that level, they wanted me to be able to develop arguments and to do research and often to make presentations, and I was able to do that. That's when I first began to realize how limited a measure standardized testing really is.
It's actually pretty amazing that you made it to college. A lot of people whose self-esteem is hurt by those tests or by their poor education that gives rise partly to poor tests don't even make it as far as you did.
Yeah, I mean, I was very fortunate that my family had the resources to send me to SAT prep classes, because if I hadn't, I would have never made it into college. And I had to take those classes over and over again. And I had to take the SAT over and over again. And in those classes, I was trained how to spot the distractor questions, right? How to eliminate wrong answer choices better than other people. And so then I got a score good enough to get me into school. But it made me realize, is this really what we want to train our young people to do? To eliminate wrong answer choices better than others? To spot distractor questions? Or do we want to train them to think, to be creative, to be empathetic, to learn how to collaborate with each other? And I think that's a clear choice for most parents. And I think that's one of the things driving this opt-out movement across the country is parents, students, and teachers have a much bigger vision for what the purpose of education is, not just to train students, but to empower them, right? And standardized tests train you in rote memorization skills, basically. But educators want to actually unlock human potential by teaching critical thinking skills.
There's so many sides to this question, because the people who do very naturally do well on those tests are people who, as you say, learn to think in that standardized way. And thinking in a standardized way doesn't necessarily mean that you are best for the profession that you are going to in the future. So in other words, if we have lots of professionals, teachers, lawyers, doctors, nurses, whose claim to fame is that they can spot distractor questions, you wonder, you know, how well those professions are functioning.
That's right. I mean, our students aren't standardized, so our assessments can't be either if they're really going to be meaningful. And once you leave public education, the standardized tests aren't really part of your everyday job anymore, right? Whatever profession or activity or community organizing that you dedicate yourself to, it's very rare that you'll be filling in A, B, C, D multiple choice bubbles in your career. And that's one of the things that I think really encouraged our staff at Garfield High School, where I teach, to fight for an alternative. You know, at my school, the entire staff in 2013 voted unanimously to refuse to give the MAP test, one of the many standardized tests the kids had to take. And after that vote, the superintendent threatened the entire staff with a 10-day suspension without pay, and not a single staff member backed down. And it became this incredible struggle that electrified Seattle. The MAP boycott spread to other schools around our city, and then it even went national and international as we got thousands upon thousands of signatures of support for our struggle. And I think it helped to ignite this opt-out movement that's spreading around the country.
How did you come to the point where you, as a group, as a unanimous group of teachers at your school, decided not to administer the test?
It started for me with one teacher who gave me a call and said she needed to talk to me after school. And so I went to Mallory Clark's classroom. She was a reading specialist. And she just sat me down and looked me in the eye and said, "I'm not giving this test this year." And it was a really exciting moment for me, because I had been organizing against this test for years, since they brought it in to the price tag of $4 million, money that we all thought should be spent on tutors or after-school programs or lowering class size, instead of one more way to rank and sort our kids. And they wanted to use it to not only evaluate students, but also tie it to teacher evaluations. And Mallory Clark was very clear. She has the data and an incredible track record at Garfield High School of taking students that enter our school, sometimes at a fourth grade reading level or below, and getting them to grade level within the year. And she said, "You know how I do that? I use the revolutionary technology of a book." Right? If I want to know what reading level they're at, I could sit them in front of a computer three times a year to take the MAP test, or I could have them read level books and find out what reading level they're at. And then I actually know the specific challenges they're having with reading, rather than just what they call a RIT score, which doesn't tell you the specific challenges they have. And so once it was clear she was going to refuse to give this test, we began organizing the faculty, and we went department by department having meetings to find out, is this test useful to you? Do you get any assessment data that helps drive your instruction? And uniformly, every instructor said it was completely useless. In fact, like our ninth grade algebra teacher said that he saw geometry questions on the test, which he used the analogy would be like if the Spanish teacher saw French questions. Okay, it's foreign language, but it's not the same subject. And so to humiliate students that they don't know this type of math was for him really harmful. And the entire faculty was willing to take a stand for struggle for authentic assessments.
So what constitutes authentic assessments?
I think authentic assessments have to be assessments that have the students actually engaged in the skill that they will be performing in real life. So I think an example that I've recently I'm writing about comes from an article that is actually quite hostile to authentic assessment. And there's a website called Education Post that's part of what I call the testocracy, mm-hmm. the multi-billionaires who are promoting more and more high-stakes testing. And they said, of course students are more than a score, but how could it hurt to give them a test to just check in and see how they're doing? we take swimming tests all the time before we swim. You take a driver's test before you drive. How could it hurt to have these kids engage in a test so we know where they're at? And to that, I would say those are perfect examples of the tests that we're in favor of. Because a swimming test, you get in the water and you swim. You're engaged in the actual activity, right? A driver's test, you get behind the car and someone actually watches you drive. Imagine if we did swimming tests like we do standardized testing in school, where you sit down, you fill in bubbles about the different types of strokes or how to swim, and then we throw you into the deep end if you get a good score. That's ludicrous. And in the public schools, there are really innovative programs around the country that do performance-based assessments. So the students are actually engaged in the type of work, research, and learning that they'll be engaged in the real world. And it works much like when someone gets their PhD, right? Because at the PhD level, they actually want you to be able to think, not just eliminate wrong answer choices. So you do research over time. You develop a thesis. If the research doesn't match the thesis, you revise your thesis. And then at the end of a term, you have to defend your thesis in front of a panel of experts. And there's a network of schools in New York called the New York Performance Consortium. And that's how they do their assessment. They have a waiver and don't have to give any of the standardized tests. And instead have their kids basically defend their dissertation, right? At the end of a term, and they bring in people from the community. So if you're in a language arts class, they can bring in an author from New York to help assess your writing. And that way the test, instead of being time away from learning, is actually time engaging with people in your field and can be moments of great breakthrough.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that sounds like an incredible opportunity for young people to get to the next level.
That's right.
And see where they stand in a community of what will be their peers once they get out into the world.
I mean, that's exactly right. Teachers aren't against tests. We invented tests, right? We just demand that these assessments be about actually understanding what our kids know and help them scaffold them to higher understanding. And, you know, the myriad of high-stakes standardized tests the kids take today is about a profit industry.
Right. I mean, that's one of the subtexts of this whole conversation.
Right.
Tell us more about that. I mean, first of all, how did standardized testing begin in the first place?
Well, in the American public school system, it has a really, really horrible history and legacy of being tied to the eugenics movement and openly white supremacist movement in the late 18, early 1900s. And actually a man named Carl Brigham was at Stanford University. And when World War I broke out, he left and started administering standardized tests called the Alpha and Beta tests to recruits to the Army. And then he, after the war was over, transformed those tests into the SAT exam, which he wanted to use specifically as a gatekeeper to his school so that it would keep out the lower classes and keep out African Americans and keep out women. And he wrote a book called A Study in American Intelligence, which was like the manifesto of the eugenics movement, basically decrying the decline of intelligence in America compared to Europe because we had more black people here. And so to me, when you look at that origin of standardized tests, you know, by 1920, some 4 million tests were being administered in the public schools, mostly at the behest of eugenicists. You can see that this is not really a tool for equity. This is a tool for ranking and sorting children. And what the tests have always registered from the early 1900s until today is a student's zip code, a student's proximity to wealth, a student's proximity to the dominant culture, not a student's skills or aptitude, right? We know that if you have the money to buy test prep, you'll do better.
Your own story.
Right?
Yeah.
So the idea that these standardized tests are a way to bring equity or challenge the achievement gap in schools today is totally laughable when you understand the origins of these tests and the way they're used today. Like in Chicago, where they shut down 50 schools with the stroke of a pen, schools that have been labeled failing with these tests. And so we see they're being used with high stakes attached so that you can close a kid's school down, you can deny them graduation, you can fire the teachers, all based on a test score. And instead of supporting those schools with more resources, providing the kids access to educational supports, they're just used to test and then punish.
Well, and that's another underlying issue that's going on here, is that the inequality of education in the United States is so gross and so widespread. I mean, I will never forget an episode of This American Life that I listened to, in which they studied the state of Missouri and the black and the white schools there. And basically, it's a long and fascinating story, and everybody should go back to the podcast and listen to it. But the upshot was, if you are an African-American public school student in the state of Missouri, you cannot get a good education.
I mean, and I think that is tied back to the severe levels of poverty and institutional racism that we have in America today. A study came out last year that shows for the first time, at least in 50 years, that the majority of students attending public school today live in poverty. And you can see, when we have a mass incarceration system in our society, where the U.S. is the biggest jailer in world history, where we're 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the prison population, and we have more black people behind bars today than were slaves on plantations in 1850. We have a total social catastrophe of poverty and racism. And the testocracy, instead of addressing poverty and racism, want to add another test to register that inequality. So they've designed an accountability system in this country that holds those with the most power the least accountable. So we want to hold students who are homeless accountable, right? We have 125 homeless students at my high school. We want to hold them accountable, but we won't hold the state politicians who have been found in contempt of court for refusing to fully fund education. They walk around free, earning, just gave themselves a raise in Washington State even, right? So they go scot-free and are completely unaccountable for supporting our kids. And I think that's a system that's completely upside down and backwards.
We're talking to Jesse Hagopian. We have a country in which not only are most states, not all, but most states fund their schools through property taxes, and so there's great inequality from one school district to another, and then you have the problem of ever-increasing and just horrifying inequality among the parents, mm-hmm. among the workers, much greater inequality that was certainly when I was in high school, and there was a lot of inequality then.
Yeah.
And so this is a problem that, as you say, really cannot be addressed by testing people. If you test people and see that one group does better in algebra than the other, well, no surprise. If you stop testing, or if you start giving these other kinds of tests that really assess where young people are at, you're still not addressing the fundamental problems of inequality and unequal funding, and basically a lack of commitment to the equality of all people in this country. I mean, it seems like we have a deep commitment to inequality.
Yeah, I think you're right. I saw a study that just came out that shows the richest 65 people have as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people, right? That is just
on
horrific.
On this planet. Oh, my goodness.
Horrific inequality. And that has to be addressed if we're going to have a true commitment to educating all of our children. I think that authentic assessments, however, can be part of the solution, because if we empower kids to think critically, if we empower kids to learn how to collaborate and work together with their peers, those are the skills that they're going to need to be able to build social movements to challenge that kind of inequality. So I think it's urgent that we move towards authentic assessments so that our kids develop the skills they'll need to actually talk back to power and to transform our world. And that's why I'm so excited about this opt-out movement. It's really a civil disobedience movement. It's an act of resistance that's sweeping the country. And we're in the midst of the largest uprising against high-stakes testing in U.S. history. There's never before been more parents, students, and teachers resisting this drill and kill rote memorization style of assessment and fighting for an alternative. And it's actually a movement that has really important antecedents. The first test resistors were black intellectuals in the early 1900s who resisted those eugenics multiple choice tests. People like W.E.B. Du Bois, who founded, one of the founders of the NAACP, wrote at length about how these tests were designed to show black inferiority, and also how we needed to bring resources to our schools. And really, that's the same struggle we're in today. And that's why I'm really excited to be here in New Mexico, because it's one of the places that has helped inspire the country to resist. When last year, hundreds upon hundreds of students streamed out of high schools around the state in Albuquerque and Santa Fe with signs reading "We're more than a score" and refusing to take the test. And it helped to transform the debate here. But we're seeing students in Chicago and Portland have walked out of these tests. There's a walkout scheduled for Friday in Baltimore that I'm going to keep my eye on, that I think looks to be majority black students organizing with this very message: bring our schools resources. We want jobs in our community, not another multi-million dollar exam that our school district buys.
Now, who's getting rich off these multi-million dollar exams?
Yeah, it's a multi-billion dollar testing industry at this point. Pearson is the most notorious of the testocracy. The Pearson Textbook and Testing Corporation is a $9 billion behemoth, and they have contracts with the new Common Core tests, and then, of course, all the test prep materials that come with it. Pearson also took over the GED program in many states, and they have, in the name of rigor, increased the difficulty of the test, basically just ensuring that more and more students fail, whether it's the Common Core tests or it's the GED. They've made it, they've made the tests incredibly developmentally inappropriate, and also at the higher grades, just incredibly difficult to make sure more students don't actually graduate. And there's a study that came out of Boston University recently. One of the author's names was Kevin Lang, and he shows that the number one outcome of exit exams requiring students to pass one of these high-stakes standardized tests to graduate is increased incarceration rates.
Oh my goodness.
Right? So we're seeing companies like Pearson make billions of dollars off of denying our kids graduation and it sending them to prison. And we're seeing high-stakes testing become one of the major factors in the school-to-prison pipeline across this country. And I think that's why growing numbers of communities of color are joining this movement and resisting.
Now, do these companies that are making so much money off of this have power and influence in Washington through lobbying, campaign contributions, other kinds of influence?
Absolutely. They're not going to leave it up to chance to find out if they get the next contract for this state or this school district. They're spending plenty of money in the political arena to lobby for us assessments that educators know don't give us good data. They don't help inform our instruction. They're really useless in terms of developing critical thinking. And so if politicians listen to the professionals and the practitioners and the educators, these tests would be gone tomorrow. But instead, they listen to testing company lobbyists. And it's a similar problem that exists, whether you're talking about healthcare, other realms. Right. Lobbyists are having such undue influence.
When you were talking a moment ago about making the GED test harder, it does make me think about something that I know has happened in New Mexico at various times. It's probably happening today, is that one of the ways that like school administrations increase graduation rates is to lower the standards. And so you've got young people graduating who may really not have earned a degree, not mm-hmm. through any fault of their own, but I mean, they're in a substandard school and then they're being pushed out with a degree. That's no good either.
That's right. And I think that really points to the urgency again of moving towards authentic forms of assessment, because if you look at the New York Consortium for Performance-Based Assessment, right, they've thrown out the high-stakes tests, and they're fully public schools. They're not charters. They don't receive any extra money than the rest of the public schools. But this network of over 30 schools uses this innovative form of assessment. And so to me, the question is, what are their outcomes, right? If they're just churning out diplomas and then the kids end up not doing well, then that's a clear sign that there's a problem. I think that the fact that they have the best outcomes of the entire New York City public school system shows you the potential for this form of assessment to really help in public education. So the New York Consortium has the highest graduation rates in New York, but beyond that, they also have the highest college attendance rates. They have the highest rates of completion of college. They have by far the best outcomes for their English language learner students. So they have some 77% of them graduating. They have 86% of their Black graduates being accepted into college. And so the outcomes are undeniable, and that's why the testocracy will never tell you about these schools, right? Because if they were right, the schools without the high-stakes tests would be the very worst schools in New York because they don't have the accountability measures.
Now, what are we talking about? Is this New York City?
Yeah, just in New York City. It's I think they're up to 38 schools now that are in this network, and they have an inquiry-based approach to education, often with social justice lens, and coupled with that, this performance-based assessment that allows the kids to speak to issues that they care about and research them, and they're having far better outcomes.
Who are the kids in these schools? Does it run all demographics of New York City?
It really does. That's what's exciting about this, because oftentimes what charter schools try to do to boost their scores is exclude students that would lower their test scores. And we've seen this across the country with charter schools pushing out at-risk students. And the New York Consortium for Performance-Based Assessment actually has a higher rate of special needs students than the regular New York City public schools, and yet have far better outcomes. And it really shows how important it is to empower our kids with this form of assessment. And I'm proud to say that at Garfield High School, we didn't just boycott the MAP test and say we're going to refuse to give a standardized test. We began a partnership with these schools that very year, and we've been flying to New York to sit in on lessons and go to trainings. Several other staff members at Garfield and our principal have been really immersed in their model. And I think it's one that the rest of the country would do well to emulate.
What is your student body like at Garfield?
Well, Garfield's the high school in the Black neighborhood, the traditionally Black neighborhood that's quickly being gentrified. So it used to be a school that was majority black. Now we're about 30% black, and then just over half students of color, whether from different Asian, African, and Latino communities, and the other half white.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about is it's sort of a truism that in order for students to do well in school, part of it is good schools, part of it is also parent engagement. How does this movement, if it does, affect parent engagement?
Well, I think the opt-out movement is engaging parents in their students' education like never before, because they realize that there's a major problem with their resources of their kids' school going to labeling their students, ranking their students, rather than teaching their students. You know, in Chicago, they have a campaign called Let Us Teach, because, you know, a study came out recently that shows the average American public school student will take 112 standardized tests in their pre-K to high school career. That's just inundating the schools with so many tests that there's no time for learning. And so parents are having to figure out what's happening in their schools in a new way and say, you know what, I want my kid to actually learn what's important to the teacher, not just what's on the next standardized test exam. And I think that's an important engagement tool. I think the other important thing to point out here is that the testocracy, the multi-billionaires, the philanthropists like Eli Broad, Bill Gates, or the Walmart family, the Waltons, they've invested so much money in promoting more and more high-stakes tests. That's why we have 112 that students take. But for their own children, what do they do for their own children?
Right.
Those kids go to elite private schools. And actually, those are the schools that should get the credit for starting the boycotts of tests, not Garfield, right? Because you can take Lakeside, which is an elite private school just up the road from Garfield, where Bill Gates went and where he sends his kids to. They never administered the MAP test, so maybe they started the MAP test boycott, right? They don't use these tests over and over because for their kids, what they want is a nurturing classroom that teaches to the whole child. They want study abroad opportunities, you know, athletics, physical education, this really wonderful liberal arts approach to learning. But for our kids, rote memorization and performance on the next test is good enough. And that's a proposition I reject. And I'm so glad that so many thousands of parents around the country are being more engaged in their students' education and rejecting it as well.
It sounds like that old model of the idea that you would train elite kids to be leaders and train everybody else to be factory workers and essentially working class people whose lives are going to be doing rote things.
No, that's right. I mean, you can see the parallels to the beginning of public education in this country, where it was both an initiative of parents who wanted their students to, they wanted their kids to have an education and everything that comes with that. But the public schools were also an initiative of industrialists who wanted a place to train students to be obedient, wanted to assimilate immigrants, especially coming from many different countries in Europe, and wanted to Americanize them and make sure that the schools indoctrinated kids with patriotism and made them good, obedient workers for their factories, right? That is the constant tension that's run throughout the history of American public education between families and educators who want to see the schools be a place to empower students with the skills they'll need to build better communities and be democratic citizens, and then corporate interests that have always wanted the schools to prioritize timeliness. Why do we have bells, right? So that you can be on time for your job. And obedience, why do we have such high levels of suspension, expulsion, and discipline in our schools? And that tension is here again today, where I think that the corporate elites would prefer that our kids not be able to think critically for most of the jobs that are in what's increasingly becoming a low-wage economy in the United States. They would like those students not to know how to challenge, how to write an op-ed about why we need a $15 minimum wage, right? They would like those students to know how to follow the directions, how to pick from a prescribed list the right answer, but not how to question whether those answers are the only ones there are in the first place.
Or whether the question is even relevant.
Whether the question is the right one, right? That's what I want to train my students. That's what I want to develop in my students, to figure out what are the right questions we should be asking.
It sounds like this movement engages students, engages parents, and also engages teachers who, I mean, there are so many people in New Mexico who are dropping out of teaching because the profession has become just untenable for them, partly because of these standardized tests, partly because of the many rules around what they are and aren't allowed to do.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really sad. The national polls around teacher morale are at an all-time low. And it's clearly a result of the federal policy of No Child Left Behind, the Race to the Top initiative, the Common Core standards. All of this high-stakes standardized testing has taken the love and the joy out of teaching, and it's creating a national teacher shortage. It's having a severe impact, so that passionate young people who used to want to become a teacher and help inspire young people can't join the profession anymore because they know it's just too stressful. And it's being dominated by corporations telling us what we need to teach rather than the individual passions of the educators.
I think when you pull back and look at the big picture and that the sort of victory of the conservative movement that started with Ronald Reagan saying that government is the problem, right, and the lack of faith in public institutions like public education, the continual unfunding or underfunding of pretty much everything except for the military and a few institutions of that kind, you have a situation where schools then have to rely on corporations. Mm. They're continually having to fundraise instead of being funded out of money that goes into the public pot from people,
right,
from their taxes, from corporate taxes. And so we are, I think, and this goes across the board, it's not just education, put in the position of simultaneously protesting a system and putting our hands out and asking for money from the same system.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, you started with Ronald Reagan, and it was under him that a report was released called A Nation at Risk, that he pointed to the rest of the world saying they're outstripping us in education and their students are doing so much better on these tests. And so we need to enter this global race for education. And it was really that initiative that set us on this path of having corporations enter the public schools in an unprecedented way, moving towards test-based accountability that was really put on steroids under George W. Bush with the No Child Left Behind Act. And unfortunately, Obama just took it to the next level and continued with all of those practices. And really what it's all been about, whether it was you know, Ronald Reagan's busting of the air traffic controllers and busting up their union, is this move towards privatization, right, in all sectors of the economy. And they look at the public school system as one of the last bastions of public control and see an opportunity for great profits to be made. And that's why in places like New Orleans, They actually have eliminated public schools altogether.
What?
Yeah. So that after Hurricane Katrina, Arne Duncan called Hurricane Katrina the greatest thing that ever happened to the New Orleans public school system, because when you wiped out the schools, they came in and were able to convert them all to privatized charters and then eliminate the union, right, and bring in low-skilled TFA, Teach for America, employees that replaced a lot of the more experienced teachers. And I think if you look at what's happened in New Orleans, that's really a model for what the testocracy wants to bring to a city near you. They want to label your schools failing with these tests so that they can close them. And then they want to reopen them as charters so that there's a private entity running the school rather than the school being under the control of a democratically elected school board.
Now, the students aren't paying to go to those schools. Where is the profit being generated? I mean, who's gaining from this?
Yeah, so the students don't pay. However, the public, the taxpayers, do pay for that school. So it's a privately run school that's publicly funded.
Okay.
And so they take the public funds, and it depends school to school, district to district, charter to charter. Some of the charters are just outright for-profit entities that are in the business of making money and educating second. Some of the charters are nonprofits, but of course nonprofits have executive boards with people that can often make exorbitant salaries. And this is all publicly funded, but then the public doesn't have the control over those schools because the school board doesn't have authority of those schools. And we've seen recent studies show that charter schools are pushing out black and brown children with higher suspension rates. And we've seen that they are not performing better than a regular public school and are not this silver bullet solution that corporate reformers have sold us.
We're talking to Jesse Hagopian. Now, we started out the program today talking about the protest that you and your colleagues at the Garfield School in Seattle did, where you said, okay, we're not going to administer this standardized test. You all stood in solidarity. The school administration, the superintendent said, oh yeah, we're going to go without pay. What happened? I mean, did they make good on their threat to dock your pay?
Well, thankfully, parents, students, and teachers rose up in our support. So there was a unanimous vote of the Garfield High School PTA in support of the teachers. The unanimous vote of the student body government in support of the teachers and the Black Student Union in support of the teachers. And then when thousands upon thousands of signatures on petitions in support of us, phone messages and emails flooding the superintendent's office, he realized that suspending us would only expand the movement many times over. And by the end of the school year, not only did he not reprimand a single teacher in any of the schools that boycotted the test, but he actually canceled the test altogether for Seattle's high schools. It was just a resounding victory for our movement, and high school students in Seattle no longer take the MAP test because of that resistance.
Now, when they don't take those tests, is there any fallout, like colleges can't evaluate them or something like that?
Yeah, colleges really don't care about any of these tests. They look at the ACT or the SAT. However, there's increasing movement amongst higher education to reject even the ACT and the SAT because the research is clear. The students who do well in college are not the students who do best on those tests. The better predictor of how well you do is your GPA, because it shows, are you able to meet the expectations of an individual educator? And so increasingly, colleges are dropping the use of SAT and ACT altogether. But a test like the MAP test is never looked at beyond the school district you're in. And the problem that we have is the proliferation of these tests, there's so much redundancy. You have the state-mandated tests that are often the Common Core exams. Here in New Mexico, that's the PARC test. In my home state of Washington, it's the SBAC test, but they're all tied to the Common Core state standards. But it's not just that test. In Seattle, we had the MAP test. Thankfully, we got rid of that. But then we also had the HISPE. We also had the EOCs. My son is in first grade now. He's supposed to take the MAP test. He's supposed to take the AMPLIFY test. And these tests, when I say the name of the test, it's not that it's given once. These are often given three times a year. So give the MAP three times a year. Give the AMPLIFY three times a year. Do the DIBELS test. I mean, it gets to be so that there's no time for learning.
You know, and that's the thing. I mean, I'm thinking back to my first grade when we actually, I remember the teacher would move the chairs and we'd dance a little bit when we got stir crazy.
I mean, cut that out. We don't do that anymore.
Right. I mean, there were so many opportunities, and in private schools, as you say, still are, mm-hmm. for things that constitute maybe social learning, critical thinking, emotional learning,
right.
interaction among students.
That's right.
If you were to wave your magic wand and really reform the educational system in a way that was good for students and good for the whole society, not just the top part of society, what's your vision?
I would bring social and emotional learning to the center of our public education system. I think that my son learning how to treat people well is the most important thing that I want him to get out of his education. Learning how to help someone who's having a bad day. Learning how to understand how other people are feeling and understand your own emotions is something that will help him be a good human being and help him fix the many problems that we face in our society. And to do that, to put social and emotional development at the center of education, you also have to put play at the center of education. And play is something that's rapidly disappearing, and it's considered frivolous and not rigorous and not standards-based with all the buzzwords that the corporate education reform testocracy has inundated our schools with. But play, as Mr. Rogers said, is really the work of childhood. As Albert Einstein said, play is the highest form of research. And it's when students have free, unstructured time that they actually learn to solve problems together. They actually learn how to share without someone telling them you have to share, right?
Right.
And what we found in across the country, and Seattle's no different where I come from, is that recess is disappearing in the Seattle public schools and around the country. There was a study that showed, especially in schools that serve kids of color, the play is disappearing and being replaced with test prep. And so part of our struggle is not just to opt out of these tests, but to increase recess. And I'm really proud that one of the demands of our union this past year was to have a mandated at least 30 minutes of recess in every elementary school.
Right.
And that's not just to have a break from learning. That is learning. That's about how to solve problems on the playground.
And as you say, I mean, social emotional learning, when your son learns to help another kid who's having a bad day, not only is he becoming a good member of society, but putting everybody in an emotional place where they become better learners.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's time to go, but it's just been wonderful having you on the air. Jesse Hagopian is a high school teacher in Seattle. He's an editor of Rethinking Schools magazine. His book is More Than a Score, The New Uprising Against High Stakes Testing. You can find more about him at IamAnEducator.com. Jesse, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me on. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.